From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the life of the late British singer Dusty Springfield. Her hits included I Only Want to Be With You, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, The Look of Love, and Son of a Preacher Man. We'll talk with Vicki Wickham, co-author of Springfield's authorized biography, which discusses the parts of her life most fans didn't know about, including that she was a lesbian. Wickham was Springfield's friend and manager. Also, we talk with actor Bob Balaban. He's a producer and co-star of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The trial for Zakaria Moussaoui is scheduled to begin in October, with jury selection 2 weeks before that. The government alleges Moussaoui was to be the 20th hijacker, but never boarded the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
Moussaoui appeared in a green jumpsuit and a full beard. Before the wrangling over trial dates began, Moussaoui addressed Judge Leonie Brinkema. In the name of Allah, he said, I do not have anything to plead. That was entered as a not guilty plea. Then they got down to timetables. Federal prosecutor Rob Spencer asked for the trial to begin on October 14th. 10 months is a long time to prepare a case for the rocket docket, as the Eastern District is called. But Moussaoui's lawyer, Jerry Zirkin, said, given the international scope of the case, the need for translations and security clearances, the defense needed at least until next February. The judge set the date for October 14th. Moussaoui has been charged with 6 counts of conspiracy in connection with the September 11th attacks. 4 of the charges can carry the death penalty. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon says U.S. Marines have completed a mission to search for clues to the whereabouts of Taliban leader Mullah Omar. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam said the operation was not aimed specifically at capturing the Taliban leader, but was an effort to gather intelligence that could help to trace him. Recovery workers at the World Trade Center site have found the bodies of at least 7 more firefighters deep in the wreckage. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
According to the union, the Uniformed Firefighters Association, the bodies of 10 firefighters, as well as 3 civilians, were pulled from the debris on New Year's Day. The fire department has a different number. It says 7 of those found have been confirmed to be firefighters. If so, that would bring the number of firefighters recovered to 134. 209 remain unaccounted for. A union spokesman says the bodies were recovered from an area of the Twin Towers lobby that was driven 30 feet underground by the impact of the tower's collapse. Meanwhile, the fire department and the union are trying to resolve a disagreement over whether firefighters should be allowed to leave their firehouses to go to Ground Zero and help carry out the body of a comrade once it's been recovered. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
A federal judge in Washington has dismissed a lawsuit by Puerto Rico that sought to stop the Navy from resuming bombing exercises on the island of Vieques. The territory tried to use a law banning loud noises to stop the Navy from resuming training on its controversial bombing range on the island. The judge said the suit couldn't be filed in federal court. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 52 points to close at 10,073 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 29 points to close at 1979. The S&P 500 closed up 6. This is NPR News. Senator Joseph Lieberman said today that his Governmental Affairs Committee will investigate the collapse of Enron. Lieberman, a Connecticut Democrat, said the committee will subpoena documents from Enron's directors, auditors, and top executives. He said the investigation will focus on why federal regulators didn't give some warning that the giant energy company was in financial difficulty. Lieberman didn't rule out that the investigation could include Enron's connections with officials in the Bush administration. Russian troops and Chechen fighters have been battling around a village south of the Chechen capital, Grozny. Casualties are reported on both sides. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Moscow.
2002 has begun like the 7 years before it in Chechnya, marked by war and death. Fighting is taking place around the village of Tsertsin Yurt, some 12 miles south of Grozny, but accounts of the battle vary greatly. A Chechen separatist website says 10 civilians died during Russian mortar attacks on the village. The Chechens say 8 of their fighters died in fighting. The Chechens claim to have killed 40 Russian soldiers. Russia's defense ministry did not mention the alleged civilian casualties. The ministry says Russian troops killed 30 Chechen fighters, while 3 Russian soldiers died. Both sides tend to exaggerate their battle accomplishments. Russian restrictions on journalists make independent confirmation impossible. Laurent Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
The ruling party candidate was sworn in today as president of Zambia despite allegations of vote fraud. Levi Mwanawasa took office under a heavy police guard after the vote count triggered widespread rioting in Zambia's capital city, Lusaka. International election observers reported that there were irregularities. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming each night of his charms that won't get you. Show him that you care. Show him that you care.
Some critics consider Dusty Springfield the best British female rock singer of the 60s. She had many hits in England and America, including Wishin' and Hopin', I Only Want to Be With You, I Just Don't Know What to Do With Myself, The Look of Love, and Son of a Preacher Man. Springfield died of cancer in 1999, just before her 60th birthday. Now a new authorized biography called Dancing with Demons describes the personal life that few of her fans knew about, including that she was a lesbian. My guest is the book's co-author, Vicki Wickham. She was Springfield's longtime friend and manager. Wickham also co-wrote one of Springfield's hits, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Here's a 1962 recording before Dusty Springfield was a solo artist, when she sang folk music with her brother and his friend under the name The Springfields.
Want your lonely mansion with a tear in every room. All I want's the love you promised beneath the haloed moon. But you think I should be happy with your money and your name and hide myself in sorrow.
The Springfields singing Silver Threads and Golden Needles. My guest Vicki Wickham first met Dusty Springfield when Springfield made a guest appearance on Ready Steady Go, the British pop music program, which Wickham co-produced.
It was a chaotic show which went out every week on Associated Rediffusion Television, which was the independent channel, and it was subtitled The Weekend Starts Here. And we were a mixture of music, fashion, the celebrities of the time, pop art. And you have to remember, this was 1963. It was The Who, The Beatles, later Jimi Hendrix, The Animals. And we started bringing in American artists, Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, Otis Redding. And it was live. It started off as a mimed show, but within a year went live. And every single week, we never quite got it right. It was a live in studio with an audience. And the cameras, I mean, literally would go between dancers, between the audience. And it just caught people's imagination. And kids would literally run home from school to see the show.
Yeah, it was kind of like American Bandstand, but with fashion and more interviews and things like that.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly what it was.
I mean, it's amazing. Like in the early days of Ready, Steady, Go, you know, the Beatles would come on and then Ringo would dance in the audience with the other dancers.
Yeah. Exactly, which, you know, was amazing because they were huge at the time.
Right. Dusty Springfield is really an extraordinary singer. And, you know, I grew up listening to her records and, you know, I always liked her, but it was as an adult that I could really appreciate what a truly good singer she is. What struck you about her singing when you were auditioning people for Ready, Steady, Go?
She had a sound, and there are very few people that have a real sound to their voice. And Dusty's just one of those lucky ones that, you know, she's recognizable anywhere. She had an impeccable choice of material. She knew exactly what was right for her voice.
Her first hit, I Only Want to Be With You, came out in 1964 and debuted on Ready, Steady, Go. And this was while you were producing the program. What did you think of the record then? Did you think that was the right choice for her?
Yes, absolutely. It was a wonderful song and a great way to launch her.
Why don't we hear it? Dusty Springfield's first hit, I Only Want to Be With You. My guest is Vicki Wickham, who co-wrote the new book, Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield. You actually co-wrote one of Dusty Springfield's songs, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which was released in 1966. How did you come to co-write this song, and tell us if there's a story behind it?
Well, there is. Dusty had been at the San Remo Song Festival and came back with an Italian song that each time she was going to record, she'd say, I must write lyrics to it. She never did, so she never recorded it. And it came to the time in 64 where she said, I really need to record this song. And I, like a big mouth, said, well, any fool can write lyrics. So she said, well, OK, if any fool can write lyrics, go and write lyrics. And luckily, I was having dinner that night with a friend of mine. Actually, I was having dinner with him every night because we used to see each other all the time. Simon Napier-Bell, who was a musician. And I said to Simon, before we go to dinner, we have to do these lyrics for Dusty because she's recording tomorrow. So he said, OK, you know, play me the song. So we sat and played, and of course we sat and argued about what it should be and what it shouldn't. But it really, in about 30 minutes, we'd got the basis of it and then finished it off in the taxi. And the next day, when I was typing them up for Dusty, I called Simon and I said, these are horrible. I cannot give these to Dusty. And he said, well, what are you going to do? So I said, I suppose give them to Dusty because there's no choice. Like, so I think I sent them through or sent them over to Dusty or dropped them off or something. And she said, these are really bad. And I said, I know, we know that. Anyway, she recorded it. And of course, it went to number one.
Why did you think they were so bad, the lyrics?
They're really inane. And if you look at the lyrics, I think the word left is in there about six times. Although, you know, when you become familiar with them, you think, okay, they're not perhaps not so bad.
So, well, why don't we hear the song and we'll let everybody judge what they think of the
okay.
lyrics. It certainly did well for her and for you. That's You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a 1966 hit by Dusty Springfield. My guest, Vicki Wickham, co-wrote the lyrics. She also co-wrote Dusty Springfield's new biography called Dancing with Demons. Now, as you were getting to know Dusty Springfield, something that you learned about her was that she was a lesbian, and this was at a time when virtually no performers were really out of the closet, certainly not in pop music. How did you find out about that?
Well, because we were friends, so we were hanging out together. We, you know, had some of the same friends. We were beginning to have our own friends. And, you know, obviously, you know, you know what your friends are doing.
And are you gay too?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you have to keep each other's secrets? Did it need to be as big a secret for you as it was for her? Because you weren't a performer and could maybe afford to be a little more open.
Well, exactly. For me, it was never a problem because I wasn't in the public eye. And, I was always openly gay and it was absolutely fine. But for somebody like Dusty, it did matter. I mean, it was absolutely unheard of in 63, in the early 60s. And I really do think it would have harmed her at the time had people really known. You have to remember, too, the press in England, it's got worse over the years, but they're very intrusive. I mean, there are a lot of tabloids. As you know, we have about 6 or 7 daily papers and then all the Sunday papers. So they need something to write about. And the more sensational it is, the better. The bigger name you are, obviously, the bigger story. And it was a real worry that, you know, the papers would start splashing it across.
And did people in the industry know and just keep it quiet, or were they clueless about it?
I think they mostly didn't know, and the few that did, you know, they weren't really particularly interested either. They were too busy with their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, your contemporaries don't care. It's really only the press and then the general public.
Dusty Springfield was from a Catholic family. She went to convent school. Did she feel guilty about her own sexual orientation?
Yes, she did. She felt guilty about a lot of things, and I think that the Catholic faith throughout her entire life always was a burden to her, and that was a large part of what the big problem was.
As a producer of Ready, Steady, Go, were you ever concerned that if she was outed, it would be a problem for the program?
No, not remotely. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would have been. The only problem we ever had with Ready, Steady was when Donovan was busted for pot, and there was a whole discussion about whether we should have him on. I mean, how inane that sounds now, but that was the biggest problem we ever had.
My guest is Vicki Wickham, co-author of Dancing with Demons, the new biography of Dusty Springfield. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vicki Wickham, and she co-wrote the new Dusty Springfield biography, Dancing with Demons. She also used to produce Ready, Steady, Go, which Dusty Springfield co-hosted early in her career, and she used to sing on it often as well. Dusty Springfield really had a look in the 60s when she became a star. Why don't you describe the kind of fashion she wore, how she did her eyes, her hairdos?
Dusty had this huge bouffant hairdo, which required a lot of backcombing and a lot of spray, which we would sometimes laugh and say that she was responsible alone for the ozone layer. She also wore a lot of makeup. She looked at the fashion magazines and the film magazines of the time and would look at people like Monica Vitti, I suppose like a Bardo, that type of thing, and she followed their eye makeup, which was a lot of black, like a panda makeup, with a lot of heavy eyeliner above the lid as well as below. And dress-wise, she was what in those days was called a mod. You had mods and rockers. And Dusty was a mod with short skirts and skimpy little tops. I mean, she was very fashionable. You know, kids would emulate her.
Dusty Springfield recorded several Burt Bacharach, Hal David songs, such as I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, Wishing and Hoping, The Look of Love. How did she start to do Bacharach?
Dusty used to listen to a lot of demos from America. Publishers would send her demos. And, of course, she was going backwards and forwards to America to appear on shows, package shows, like at the ones at the Brooklyn Fox, where she would be on with Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, The Searchers, The Animals, Dusty. So she was very conscious of American music. And she and I and Vic Billings, her manager at the time, went to Paris, and at the Olympia in Paris went to see Dionne Warwick, the Shirelles, little Stevie Wonder, who was singing Fingertips at the time. And she met Dionne Warwick, and we came back with heaps of records. So inevitably, a lot of those, of course, were Bacharach and David. In fact, all of them were Bacharach and David.
And she liked the songs and wanted to start recording them herself?
Loved the songs, yes.
So did she get in touch with Bacharach?
Yes. And I think that Bert, I mean, feels that her version of Look of Love is still the ultimate.
What do you think of her recording of that?
I think it's wonderful. I think it captures every essence of the song. It's beautiful.
Why don't we hear it?
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your heart can't disguise. The look just words can ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that
That's Dusty Springfield singing The Look of Love, which was from the film Casino Royale and was another big hit for her. The song was by Bacharach and David. Dusty Springfield did at least one of the songs that Dionne Warwick did as well. Dionne Warwick also did I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. Did Dusty Springfield feel competitive with Dionne Warwick when it came to doing Burt Bacharach songs?
No, I think she loved Dionne's voice. She respected Dionne. She actually became friends with Dionne. I think she could have been slightly jealous that Dionne got the songs first from Bert and Hal, because, of course, Dionne was doing their demos and had first, you know, crack at the songs. But no, I don't think there was actually competitiveness, because Dusty would only do a song if she could do it her way, which she always did.
And do you know if Dionne Warwick felt competitive with Dusty Springfield?
Again, I don't think competitive is the right word. I would think pissed was the right word. I mean, if I were an American and had a great record and had success in the charts in America, and then some English bird was copying it and having success in England, I wouldn't be too happy.
Do you think Dionne Warwick saw it as copying her records?
Yes, I'm sure she did.
In the new authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, you write about her depressions. You say she was diagnosed as manic depressive, and her depressions were sometimes very severe. What was she like on either end of her mood swings?
She could go into the blackest moods ever, and very irrational in terms of nothing was right, nothing was good enough, including herself. Just really deep depressions, which would last sometimes for minutes, and it usually resulted in damaging some innate object of some sort. Never a danger to anybody else or at that point herself. And then on the other end, you know, when she'd come out of them, she was the most intelligent, wonderful, funny, interesting, up person imaginable. I mean, it's hard when she was her normal self, it was hard to imagine that she could possibly be any other way.
She also mutilated herself. She cut on her arms and legs. I think much more is known about that kind of self-mutilation now than was known then. It seems either more common or at least more publicly discussed. How did she and her doctors deal with it? And I don't know whether this was mostly in the 1960s or 70s.
It was both. At the time, you're right, I mean, not that much was known about it. And the biggest thing that I think was a mistake, and I mean, she felt the same way, she never found any help for it, meaning a shrink, a therapist. You know, the British are very anti that type of thing, especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we all felt that a good cup of tea would solve everything rather than going to talk to somebody. And of course, now we know better that, you know, it does help to have some professional advice and professional help. And at the time, nobody was really doing that. Even in terms of medication, none of the doctors were really prescribing anything, which nowadays, I don't know if it's Prozac or what they would give you, but they would give you something to help you get through it. At the time, nobody was doing that. So it became an occurrence which would happen far too frequently. And, you know, like with anything like that, it's a cry for help, and nobody was helping.
How did you find out about the cutting?
Various phone calls from emergency rooms or, you know, calls in the night from somebody or from Dusty herself. And, you know, it just, again, you know, none of us were qualified to help. You can offer support, you can, you know, help on that level, but it wasn't obviously enough.
Would the scars or the cuts show when she wore the kind of clothes she liked to wear? You know, in other words, was she in risk of performing with cuts and scars showing?
Yes, absolutely. And if you notice, she almost always, in fact, always would wear long sleeves.
And that's why?
Yes.
Vicki Wickham is the co-author of Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I just don't know what to do with myself. Don't know just what to do with myself. I'm so used to
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life by Philip Simmons, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up by Michael T. Murray, M.D., co-author of Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Bob Balaban. He's appeared in dozens of movies, and on Seinfeld, he played the network head who bought Jerry and George's sitcom idea. Balaban produced and co-stars in the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. Also, more on the life of Dusty Springfield. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Vicki Wickham, co-author of Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, the British singer who became popular in the 60s and had such hits as Wishin' and Hopin', The Look of Love, I Only Want to Be With You, and The Son of a Preacher Man. Springfield died of cancer in 1999. Vicki Wickham was her friend and manager. When we left off, we were talking about Springfield's problems with depression. Would the depression go away when she was on stage?
It's interesting you should say that. Absolutely. Dusty, as much as she hated getting on stage, was scared stiff about it, once she got on stage, was A, the true professional, was absolutely wonderful, and thoroughly enjoyed herself.
Did you ever have to convince her to get on stage?
Constantly. It was always an uphill battle. I mean, as a manager, it really was very depressing sometimes that you'd have these wonderful offers, and I'd call her up and I'd say, okay, you know, this is what somebody wants you to do. Here are the pros, here are the cons. This is what the money is. This is what I, you know, should be. Let's talk about it. And it would always be no. Then I would get a call sort of 15 minutes later or 20 minutes later. Okay, you know, tell me more. What about, what if? And she would always come, she was wonderful actually. She'd come up with a huge list of, we should ask them this, that, and the other, which is, you know, absolutely the right thing to do. And we would ask them this, that, and the other, and we'd go backwards and forwards. And then it would always be, I don't think I'm ready to do it at the moment. Let's think about it next time. And so during the time I was managing her, she did very, very few performances, a few, televisions, recording, but not live performances.
Do you think that she would forget how much she enjoyed being on stage?
Yes, I do. I think the effort to get on stage outweighed the pleasures or the remembrance of the pleasures when she was on. Having to put on the makeup, having to put on, you know, the clothes, the hair, having to be scrutinized, it just became too much effort. And I actually do understand it. I think that she should have overcome it, and we all tried to help her overcome it and make it as pleasurable as possible. And when she was doing a television, there would be a team, Debbie Dennell, who did her makeup, whoever was doing her hair, Pat, myself. I mean, a whole group of us would, you know, be around so that we could have some fun, we could have a giggle, we could make it as light and easy as possible. But at the end of the day, it was still Dusty that had to get herself together.
When did Dusty Springfield find out that she had cancer?
She called me up one day and said, at the end of the conversation, sort of very casually said, did I tell you that I found a lump in my breast? Which I said, no. And what did your doctor say? To which she said, I don't really have a doctor. I haven't been to see anybody. I said, Dust, get off the phone. Let me make you an appointment with mine. I'll call you right back. So I called my doctor, called her right back. 2 days later, we were in my doctor's office, and the doctor said, basically to all of us, yes, there is a lump. I want you to go and see Ian Smith at the Marsden. And we came out, and of course, there was the usual crowd of us, and went and had our usual cup of tea and said, well, it could be worse. At least, you know, they know the lump's there. Perhaps they can do something. They're sending you to a great specialist. And we were all trying to be, you know, incredibly optimistic. But of course, when she went to the Marsden, they said, yes, it is cancer. We need to shrink the lump, which they did. And then they do what they call is a lumpectomy, which they take the actual lump out. And at that stage, it hadn't spread into the glands or anything. Did chemo, did some radiation, and we thought she was clear, which was magnificent. So the record came out, did all the promotion, which must have been grueling for her, but, you know, thinking that she was absolutely okay. And then she went for a holiday in Ireland and started, strange, having some sort of cough. And when she came back, went back to check, and they said, yep, you know, it's come back and we need to be more aggressive this time around.
And so she took more aggressive chemo after that?
She did. And also, Dusty was a very well-informed person. And what she didn't know, she certainly would find out. She went to every possible source on the internet, friends, et cetera, to find out what treatment was effective, what could be done, what America was doing. Called several people in America and in hospitals and stuff and said, this is what, you know, I'm doing at the Marsden. Is there anything you would recommend? Just was really well informed, and to their credit, the Marsden were wonderful and tried a couple of things that hadn't been approved in England. They actually went to the association and got approval to use the drugs on Dusty, which was, you know, very brave and good of them, because I do think it's your choice what you want. But unfortunately, none of them did the trick.
How did she handle the news that the cancer had come back?
Scared as hell, as we all would be, but absolutely determined that she would beat it. I mean, she felt that she'd beaten it before. She felt that she'd basically in life had many close brushes with her life, that she'd always beaten it. She felt she was in great shape emotionally, just in her life in general, and that she would beat it.
Did she ever, by the way, come out as a lesbian?
No.
Even when she knew she was dying?
No. There was no, you know, in a way, there was sort of no interest in her from that point of view at that stage. The papers were interested in the cancer, and it never really cropped up.
Did she wish, do you think, that she could have been more honest about herself?
Yes, because she was a very outgoing person. She wasn't a secretive person at all. I'm quite sure that she wished she could have been.
You were at her funeral when she died?
Yes.
What was the funeral like, and was there any of her music that was played there?
Yes, I put it together with Simon Bell, the two of us, and I just said to Simon, you know, Dust was such a star, an artist, we have to just have a very grand funeral. And as you know, the body was put in an open horse-drawn carriage, which has stopped the traffic in Henley. And yes, it was all her music. We played Going Back, which is very apt, a Goffin and King song. And the coffin actually went out to You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And as it came out of the church, the crowd outside, I'm only laughing because she would have loved it, broke into applause. And Elton said, it's the only funeral I've ever heard of that the coffin gets the applause. She would have definitely been chuffed and had a giggle.
It must have been odd for you to produce her funeral after having worked with her for so many years.
It was bizarre, but it kind of completed the cycle for me. I mean, in a way, I just didn't believe that she was dead. And by doing the funeral and going through that, it actually closed the book, which was wonderful.
Vicki Wickham is co-author of Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield.
Son. And when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Passing Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows, to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.
Coming up, Bob Balaban, one of the producers and stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. This is Fresh Air. My guest Bob Balaban is one of the producers and co-stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. The filmmakers describe it as part Agatha Christie murder mystery and part Upstairs, Downstairs. It's set in 1932 on a British country estate where friends and family have gathered for a shooting party. The guests have brought their servants. Of course, there's a murder in the house. The family, friends, and servants are all suspects. Bob Balaban is part of the star-studded ensemble cast. He plays an American movie producer who's in England making the film Charlie Chan in London. Balaban has appeared in many films, including Prince of the City, Deconstructing Harry, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, Ghost World, and The Majestic. In Seinfeld, he had a recurring role as the network executive who bought Jerry and George's sitcom idea. I asked Bob Balaban about Altman's approach to recording overlapping dialogue. He described a scene in which all the guests are gathered in one room and many conversations are underway.
To shoot scenes and record the dialogue with this many people, Bob does something very radical, which is he has 19 microphones. Every single person out there on that huge set had their own individual body mic and their own individual track on which their dialogue was recorded. So at any point in the proceedings, Bob could listen to 19 different things going on in the group scenes when we were at the table and we were in the dining room and the living room. He could select anybody's dialogue and bring it up and remove anybody else's dialogue who wasn't on their microphone. This is a nightmare. Now, you could be neurotic and indecisive, and you could spend 30 years cutting a movie that's got dialogue like that because you have so many choices. Bob very quickly listens to everything, and he goes, that's funny, that's not funny. Okay, this is good. This is what I want. It's really one of the reasons why Bob must operate in a situation that's not a bureaucracy, you know, that isn't directing by committee with a lot of executives telling him what to do, because he operates so instinctively, and also it would take so long. I mean, the reason that his movies have that Robert stamp to them is he's in complete control of everything, and he needs to be.
Now, as an actor, when you're working in a situation like that, say there's a lot of people in the living room, mm-hmm. everybody's engaged in a conversation, you have your lines, they're being recorded, but you don't know if they're going to actually be used in the movie or not.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I think it's a great thing for a movie. I found that the first scene I shot in the movie was my character was introduced. We all got into the house. There were 23 people in the scene. And I went around going, hello, I'm Morris Wiseman. And then Maggie Smith would go, you know, she wouldn't exactly say hello. And we did the lines we were supposed to say. But then, because I was off in the corner with somebody and the camera was constantly moving, all the scripted lines were spoken during the course of a 3-page scene. And yet, whenever you weren't on camera, you had to maintain a conversation with whoever you were with. Well, that's like rehearsing a play. It's like fabulous background. Oh, this is how my character talks to that person. This is what it feels like to be in the house. This is what my character is noticing right now. You literally get to live and breathe in your costume on the set while you're shooting a great improvisation that is great background for yourself. And after a few days of this, you really do learn a tremendous amount about the world that you're inhabiting. It was a great, great learning experience.
So you're improvising conversations that Altman is recording during the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. Were any of your improvised lines actually used in the film?
Oh, many of them. But many of all of ours. But the movie, I must stress, this is not an improvised movie in any way. I was in Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show, and that is only an improvised movie. That's a basic outline, and then you just say whatever you want. We only did this when we were in large group scenes that needed this to fill in. Otherwise, if you notice other people's movies, usually that have a lot of people in them, everybody's kind of going blah, 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 and they're kind of fake doing whatever it is they're doing, and then they say a real line, and then the camera must get to them at that point. In our case, if the camera lingered on you, there's a wide shot when we're leaving, going for our pheasant hunt, and I was just chatting with Jeremy Northam, and with literally, there are probably 32 characters in this very wide shot, and I come out there, and I started saying to Jeremy, we're going to shoot pheasants, and both me and my character are not exactly woodsmen. And so I said to Jeremy, gee, you know, are pheasants ever dangerous? And then I went on this whole long thing about, yeah. you know, how frightened I was of pheasants, which is true, actually. I with the idea that a pheasant would rush at you and claw your eyes out, I don't know, it could be frightening. Yeah, and he put that in the movie, and it actually gets a rather nice laugh. But I really, at that point, it was such a wide shot, I had no idea what was happening. And working with Robert, and it's not that you always have to be tricked into this, because you really don't. But there is such a feeling of at ease with what you're doing with him, whether it's long shots where they're recording everything and you just get used to it and you stop noticing when you're rolling or not, or small little intimate scenes. He just creates an atmosphere along with this all that lets you know you can be very relaxed, you're very trusting of him, and you know that if it's not working, he just won't put it in the movie because he has consummate taste. He's not just warm and fuzzy. He's got great taste. If something's not working, he doesn't put it in.
Now, you actually come from quite an interesting movie family. Your uncle was the president of Paramount Pictures. Your grandfather headed production at MGM. And your father was one of the co-owners of the Balaban and Katz theaters. These were movie theaters or vaudeville theaters turned into movie theaters?
Well, actually, my father, who I'll talk about in a second, was a little baby when this was all happening. My dad was the youngest of seven brothers in Chicago. And my grandparents had a little grocery store where they all slept like in one room in the back. In 1908, my grandmother walked into a movie theater and said to my uncles, "Kids, this is the movie we're going to go, movie, this is the business." My grandmother went to a movie theater in 1908. She went to a Nickelodeon, and when she went in, she was amazed by the way the thing was run, and she went to her children and she said, "This is the business that we're going to go in. Where else do you pay your money before you see what you're going to get? This is the wave of the future. We have to do this." It's not, and also, it's not like lettuce. The lettuce gets stale and old. You throw it away. The movie gets old. They've seen it. You send it back to them, and they send you a new movie. It was like perfect. So they went heavily into the movie business, hawking everything they had, starting in this tiny little theater, which I think opened in 1908 or 9, the year my father was born. And within 7 or 8 years, they had about 150 movie theaters in the Midwest, pleasure palaces, these giant, beautiful works of art designed in many of them by the firm of Rapp & Rapp that sort of specialized in this sort of quasi-Egyptian stuff, but very ornate, very beautiful, and it was just an amazing time. The oldest brother, Barney, then left Balaban & Katz, took over Paramount from Adolf Zucker eventually, and then was in partnership with Balaban and Katz, because at that time in history, movie studios owned movie theaters, and it was like a perfect combination to control the Midwest and have, you know, the older brother be at Paramount. It was like an amazing thing. And then, of course, antitrust legislation knocked this out. I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but a lot of my relatives became Republicans at that point, because Democrats were responsible for this. But where they were born in Chicago was this street called Maxwell Street, which was essentially the Lower East Side of Chicago. It was like Orchard Street in New York. And on this one little stretch of push carts and cobblestones and very, very poor immigrants, Benny Goodman was on the left. William Paley's family was on the right. Jack Ruby, oddly enough, lived down the block from all of them. And Rickover lived,
the
I think, across the street, Admiral Rickover, Hyman Rickover. So it was this little melting pot that sent roots out that affected everything everywhere. It was such, must have been in something in the water, I think. I'm not sure.
Did you spend time in the projection booth as a kid?
I loved movies, and I was always sitting in theaters. My favorite thing was, in my dad's office, they had to screen movies to see what they would be buying and playing. I don't know if they really had to, but they loved seeing the movies, and I did too. And when I was a kid, every once in a while, they would drag me on a Tuesday night, because that's when they saw the new movies, to the office where I got to see it was a screening room. I just couldn't believe it. I was 8 or 9 or whatever. And they would show me these things. I remember I went to see my first X-rated movie. I was a kid, and my parents were very liberal about stuff like that. And they said, "Well, don't be shocked, but you're seeing an X-rated movie." It was I Am a Camera. It starred Julie Harris. It's Christopher Isherwood. It's what became Cabaret, you know, basically. And the movie was over, and I was so disappointed. I was a little kid. I told my friends I was seeing an X-rated movie, and my parents approved. I couldn't figure out the dirty part of the movie, because eventually what they did was, many times you'd see them and they'd say, "Yes, we made love last night," or "We're going to make love." And they would say things like that. And of course, in 1954 in Chicago or wherever, that was, you couldn't say you were going to make love to somebody. You could say, "I would kiss you." I thought making love meant kissing somebody and being very nice to them. I had no idea they were actually sleeping together. So that was my first X-rated movie experience. And then I was in an X-rated movie.
Oh, Midnight Cowboy.
I was the X rating.
Describe the scene.
I'm a kid who picks up a hustler on Times Square, John Voight, the Midnight Cowboy, and we have an experience in the balcony of a movie theater, which was very discreet, but you knew exactly what I was doing, and then I threw up in the men's room afterwards, and that was the next little scene in the movie. And when the movie came out, I was the reason for the hard, well, I guess you'd call it a hard R, I don't know, but it was X-rated. You if you were under 17, you were not allowed to see the movie because of that little moment, which was very modest, I promise. And then after it got the Best Picture Award, mysteriously the rating changed. Now it was an R. Now you could see the movie. I guess it was artistic enough that you could stand what was happening.
Although you're directing and producing now as well as acting, you started your career as an actor. Did your family hold actors in high regard?
No. They were kind about me because I was their family, you know. And also I was not horrendously successful. I was just working. I mean, the fact that in my generation, a lot of my relatives, you know, didn't do all that much, and they certainly weren't in the movie business necessarily. They had comfortable lives, and they inherited things from their parents, and they didn't. I think the fact that I was out there sort of struggling and actually making a living was very, my father was proud of that fact because in a way I didn't exactly have to be, you know, peddling myself the way I was and pushing myself. I didn't exactly have to, although it's sort of debatable.
My guest is actor, producer, and director Bob Balaban. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Balaban. He's one of the producers and co-stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. Bob Balaban, I want to read you what Leonard Maltin's Encyclopedia of Film says about you in the Bob Balaban entry.
Oh.
He writes, during the late 70s and 80s, producers looking for physically unprepossessing, soft-spoken, intellectual types rarely got past the letter B in their casting directories.
Oh.
No one surpassed Balaban in those roles, and the more dispassionate or loathsome the character, the better he was. Now, from your point of view, how did your unprepossessing, intellectual type look affect your casting?
When I was 17 years old and I was in summer stock in Chicago, an actress who was terribly old, she was 38 or something, came up to me and she said, you know, it's very interesting, Bob. You're going to do very well, I think, in New York, and maybe you'll even get into movies. As long as they have parts where you're supposed to look intelligent, you're going to get work. I had no idea what she was talking about, and because, you know, I'm smart enough, you know, but I'm hardly a great genius or intellectual exactly. But I guess I must seem that way because I've always been cast that way. Now, there are times when I wasn't. In Jacob the Liar, a movie that I liked a lot that Robin Williams starred in, and I was the barber. I was actually a barber. I actually talked loud. I was emotional. I did stuff. I can do those things, but, you know, I'm not cast that way that much. Do I mind it? In a way, I might, but in a way, I'm also lucky I get work. You know, I'm happy when I get a job. So I'm glad they know what to make of me in some way.
Now, our engineer for Fresh Air has done a lot of sound work in theater. And he, Bob Purdick, was telling me about a time when he worked in a production that you were starring in, in which you had to grab somebody by their lapels. And you were grabbing so tight that when they pulled away...
I broke my fingers.
You broke your finger. Fingers, more than
well,
one?
Well, two of them, actually.
Really?
He knew that? He remembered that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my God. That was Speed the Plow, David Mamet on Broadway. I replaced Ron Silver, who won a Tony Award. It was foolish of me to do that, but I had a great time, and I loved to play. And my finger is still sort of bent because I did it 2 years later again, and I broke my finger.
You did it again, and you broke your finger?
Mm-hmm. Different play. I grabbed a guy by a Jules Pfeiffer play, grabbed him by the lapels too hard. Don't grab people by the lapels. It's my advice to you.
Yeah, it was the Jules Pfeiffer play that our engineer
Was it? Well, I had done it in Speed the Plow 2 years before and broken the same finger.
So what went wrong? You were just holding on too tight when they pulled away?
I did the play for a year or 9 months or whatever. And, you know, we had a very well-choreographed fight. It was beautifully done by a very famous person who does all the fights on Broadway. And I'm, you know, 2 feet tall, and I had to grab somebody who was 6'9" or something and shake him by the lapels, throw him to the ground, and then stand over him and scream at him. I mean, it was a fun, exciting moment for me to have, and I thought I eventually pulled it off perfectly well. But you do the same thing like that for months and months and months, you're bound to, at some point, something's bound to happen usually. And it was my finger. Thank you. I'm glad it wasn't my head.
Did you continue with the rest of the show?
I did. And then I rushed off to the emergency room, and I had to wait for 10 hours, and I couldn't wait, and I came back and did the next show. And, you know, it was just my finger, but it hurt.
So you had to do the next show before they actually repaired, you know, put it in a cast or whatever?
The show must go on, they say.
How did it heal?
Badly. It's still sore. You know, fingers are kind of tricky. You know, we could have a whole finger show, actually. they put it in a cast, and they fiddled around with it, and they don't do that much. You know, if you ever broke your toe, mostly they just say, wear tight shoes, you know. It hasn't progressed a lot from the Neanderthal days.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Northam plays Ivor Novello in Gosford Park, your new movie. Mm-hmm. Yep. And Ivor Novello was a real singer and performer, songwriter. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy Northam sings some Ivor Novello songs. Whose idea was it to make him a character, to make that real person a character mm-hmm. in the film?
That character came in late in the drafts and probably only a few months, well, maybe 5 months before we started shooting, because Robert Altman wanted there to be source music. You know, he's sort of famous for that. A lot of his movies have found ways to include real performances of music during the movies in Kansas City. There was a lot of that. And Bob is very musical. You know, he really is. He's like a jazz musician himself, at least internally. I don't know if he can really play anything. He's very musical. And he wanted there to be this character. He came in one day and he said, it's perfect. Ivor Novello, I love his music. It'll be the centerpiece of the movie. It can be the end credits. I mean, he exactly knew what he was going to do at that point. And the fact that Ivor was not that famous, I mean, he was then, but to you and to me, you probably don't know what he looked like. We got to have a famous, a historical person in the movie, but who was not so famous that you would be worried that Jeremy should look like him or really sound like him. Then it turned out that Jeremy Northam has a beautiful singing voice and did just a fantastic job, and he played the piano even. We didn't even know that, you know, when we cast him. It was just lucky.
Well, Bob Balaban, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Terry. I love your show. I think it's fantastic.
Bob Balaban is one of the producers and stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House. Publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up by Michael T. Murray, M.D. Co-author of Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the letters between Eleanor Roosevelt and the man she was closest to in the last 15 years of her life, Dr. David Gurewitch. We'll talk with Gurewitch's widow, Edna Gurewitch, author of Kindred Souls. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.